The five friends had finished dinner. Five men of the world. Mature, rich, three married, two others bachelors. They met like this every month in memory of their youth. And after dinner, they chatted until 2 in the morning. Having remained intimate friends and enjoying each other's society, they probably considered these the pleasantest evenings of their lives. They talked on every subject, especially of what interested and amused Parisians. Their conversation was, as in the majority of salons elsewhere, a verbal rehash of what they had read in the morning papers. One of the most lively of them was Joseph de Bardon, a celibate, living the Parisian life in its fullest and most whimsical manner. He was not a debauchee, nor depraved, but a singular, happy fellow, still young, for he was scarcely 40, a man of the world in its widest and best sense, gifted with a brilliant but not profound mind, with much varied knowledge but no true erudition, ready comprehension without true understanding. He drew from his observations, his adventures, from everything he saw, met with, and found, anecdotes at once comical and philosophical, and made humorous remarks that gave him a great reputation for cleverness in society. He was the after-dinner speaker, and had his own story each time, upon which they counted, and he talked without having to be coaxed. As he sat smoking, his elbows on the table, a small glass half full beside his plate, half torpid in an atmosphere of tobacco blended with steaming coffee, he seemed to be perfectly at home. He said between two whiffs, "A curious thing happened to me some time ago." "Tell it to us," they all exclaimed at once. "With pleasure." "You know that I wander about Paris a great deal, like book collectors who ransack bookstalls. I just look at the sights, and at the people, and at all that is passing by, and all that is going on. Toward the middle of September, it was beautiful weather, I went out one afternoon, not knowing where I was going. One always has a vague wish to call on some pretty woman or other. One chooses among them in one's mental picture gallery, compares them in one's mind, weighs the interest with which they inspire you, their comparative charms, and finally decides according to the influence of the day. But when the sun is very bright and the air warm, it takes away from all you desire to make calls. The sun was bright, the air warm. I lighted a cigar and sauntered aimlessly along the outer boulevard. Then, as I strolled on, it occurred to me to walk as far as Montmartre and to go into the cemetery. I am very fond of cemeteries. They rest me and give me a feeling of sadness. I need it. And besides, I have good friends in there, those that one no longer goes to call on, and I go there from time to time. It is in this cemetery of Montmartre that is buried a romance of my life, a sweetheart who made a great impression on me, a very emotional, charming little woman whose memory, although it causes me great sorrow, also fills me with regrets, regrets of all kinds, and I go to dream beside her grave. She has finished with life. And then I like cemeteries because they are immense cities filled to overflowing with inhabitants. Think how many dead people there are in this small space. Think of all the generations of Parisians who are housed there forever, veritable troglodytes enclosed in their little vaults, in their little graves covered with a stone or marked by a cross, while living beings take up so much room and make so much noise, imbeciles that they are. Well, there I was in Montmartre Cemetery, and was all at once filled with sadness, a sadness that is not all pain, a kind of sadness that makes you think, when you are in good health, this place is not amusing, but my time has not yet come. The feeling of autumn, of the warm moisture which is redolent of the death of leaves, and the weakened, weary, anemic sun increased while rendering it poetical, and the sensation of solitude and of finality that hovered over this spot which savors of human mortality. I walked along slowly amid these streets of tombs, where the neighbors do not visit each other, do not sleep together, and do not read the newspapers. And I began to read the epitaphs. That is the most amusing thing in the world. Never did Liboche or Médiac make me laugh as I have laughed at the comical inscriptions on tombstones. Oh, how much superior to the books of Paul de Kock for getting rid of the spleen are these marble slabs and these crosses, where the relatives of the deceased have unburdened their sorrow, their desires for the happiness of the vanished ones, and their hope of rejoining them. Humbugs. But I love above all in the cemetery the deserted portion, solitary, full of great yews and cypresses, the older portion, belonging to those dead long since, and which will soon be taken into use again the growing trees nourished by human corpses cut down in order to bury in rows beneath little slabs of marble those who have died more recently. When I sauntered about long enough to refresh my mind, I felt that I would soon have had enough of it, and that I must place the faithful homage of my remembrance of my little friend's last resting place. I felt a tightening of the heart as I reached her grave. Poor dear, she was so dainty, so loving, and so white and fresh. And now, if one should open the grave. Leaning over the iron grating, I told her of my sorrow in a low tone, which she doubtless did not hear, and moving away when I saw a woman in black, in deep mourning, kneeling next to a grave. Her crepe veil was turned back, uncovering a pretty fair head, and the hair in Madonna bands looking like rays of dawn beneath her somber headdress. I stayed. Surely she must be in profound grief. She had covered her face with her hands, and, standing there in meditation, rigid as a statue, gave up to her grief, telling the sad rosary of her remembrances within the shadow of her concealed and closed eyes. She herself seemed like a dead person mourning another who was dead. All at once, a little motion of her back, like a flutter of wind through a willow, led me to suppose that she was going to cry. She wept softly at first, then louder, with quick motions of her neck and shoulders. Suddenly, she uncovered her eyes. They were full of tears and charming, the eyes of a bewildered woman, with which she glanced about her as if wakening from a nightmare. She looked at me, seemed abashed, and hid her face completely with her hands. Then she sobbed convulsively, and her head slowly bent down toward the marble. She leaned her forehead on it, and her veil, spreading around her, covered the white corners of the beloved's tomb like a fresh token of mourning. I heard her sigh, and then she sank down with her cheek on the marble slab and remained there, motionless, unconscious. I darted toward her, slapped her hands, blew on her eyelids, while I read this simple epitaph. Here lies Louis Theodore Carrel, captain of Marine Infantry, killed by the enemy at Tonkin. Pray for him. He had died some months before. I was affected to tears and redoubled my attentions. They were successful. She regained consciousness. I appeared very much moved. I am not bad-looking. I am not 40. I saw by her first glance that she would be polite and grateful. She was. And amid more tears, she told me her history in detached fragments as well as her gasping breath would allow. How the officer was killed at Tonkin when they had been married a year. How she had married for love. And being an orphan, she had only the usual dowry. I consoled her. I comforted her, raised her, and lifted her on her feet. Then I said, "Do not stay here. Come."
"I am unable to walk," she murmured.
"I will support you."
"Thank you, sir. You are good. Did you also come to mourn for someone?"
"Yes, madam."
"A dead friend?"
"Yes, madam."
"Your wife?"
"A friend."
"One may love a friend as much as they love their wife. Love has no law."
"Yes, madam."
And we set off together, she leaning on my arm, while I almost carried her along the path of the cemetery. When we got outside, she faltered.
"I feel as if I'm going to be ill."
"Would you like to go in anywhere, to take something?"
"Yes, monsieur."
I perceived a restaurant, one of those places where the mourners of the dead go to celebrate the funeral. We went in. I made her drink a cup of hot tea, which seemed to revive her. A faint smile came to her lips. She began to talk about herself. It was sad, so sad to be always alone in life, alone in one's home, night and day, to have no one on whom one can bestow affection, confidence, intimacy.
That sounded sincere. It sounded pretty from her mouth. I was touched. She was very young, perhaps 20. I paid her compliments, which she took in good part. Then, as time was passing, I suggested taking her home in a carriage. She accepted, and in the cab we sat so close that our shoulders touched. When the cab stopped at her house, she murmured,
"I do not feel equal to going upstairs alone, for I live on the fourth floor. You have been so good. Will you let me take your arm as far as my own door?"
I agreed with eagerness. She ascended the stairs slowly, breathing hard. Then, as we stood at her door, she said,
"Come in for a few moments so that I may thank you."
And, by Jove, I went in. Everything was modest, even rather poor, but simple and in good taste.
We sat down side by side on a little sofa, and she began to talk again about her loneliness. She rang for her maid in order to offer me some wine. The maid did not come. I was delighted, thinking that this maid probably came in the morning only, what one calls a charwoman. She had taken off her hat. She was really pretty, and she gazed at me with her clear eyes, gazed so hard, and her eyes were so clear that I was terribly tempted. I caught her in my arms and rained kisses on her eyelids, but she closed suddenly. She freed herself and pushed me away, saying, "Have done, have done." But I next kissed her on the mouth, and she did not resist. And as our glances met after this outraging the memory of the captain killed in Tonkin, I saw she had a languid, resigned expression that set my mind at rest. I became very attentive, and after chatting for some time, I said, "Where do you dine?"
"In a little restaurant in the neighborhood."
"All alone?"
"Why, yes."
"Would you dine with me?"
"Where?"
"In a good restaurant on the boulevard."
She demurred a little.
I insisted. She yielded, saying by way of apology to herself, "I am so lonely, so lonely." Then she added,
"I must put on something less somber,"
and went into her room. When she reappeared, she was dressed in half mourning, charming, dainty, and slender,
in a very simple gray dress. She evidently had a costume for the cemetery and one for the town.
The dinner was very enjoyable. She drank some champagne, brightened up, grew lively, and I went home with her. This friendship, begun amidst the tombs, lasted about 3 weeks. But one gets tired of everything, especially of women. I left her under pretext of an imperative journey. She made me promise that I would come and see her on my return. She seemed to be really rather attached to me. Other things occupied my attention, and it was about a month before I thought much about this little cemetery friend. However, I did not forget her. The recollection of her haunted me, like a mystery, like a psychological problem, one of those inexplicable questions whose solution baffles us. I do not know why, but one day I thought I might possibly meet her in the Montmartre Cemetery, and I went there. I walked about a long time without meeting any but the ordinary visitors to this spot, those who have not yet broken off all relations with their dead. The grave of the captain killed at Tonkin had no mourner on its marble slab, no flowers, no wreath. But as I wandered in another direction of this great city of the dead, I perceived suddenly, at the end of a narrow avenue of crosses, a couple in deep mourning walking toward me, a man and a woman. Oh, horrors! As they approached, I recognized her. It was she. She saw me, blushed. As I brushed past her, she gave me a little signal, a tiny little signal with her eye, which meant, "Do not recognize me," and also seemed to say, "Come back to see me again, my dear." The man was a gentleman, distinguished, chic, an officer of the Legion of Honor, about 50 years old. He was supporting her as I had supported her myself when we were leaving the cemetery. I went my way filled with amazement, asking myself what this all meant. Of what race of beings belonged this huntress of the tombs? Was she just a common girl, one who went to seek among the tombs for men who were in sorrow, haunted by the recollection of some woman, a wife, or a sweetheart, and still troubled by the memory of vanished caresses? Was she unique? Are there many such? Is it a profession? Do they parade the cemetery as they parade the street? Or else, was she only impressed with the admirable, profoundly philosophical idea of exploiting love's recollections, which are revived in these funeral places? And I would have liked to know whose widow she was on that special day. Read by Roy Schreiber.